I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. Gentlemen, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Oh, ho, ho.
There we go. This is our second annual Christmas episode, friends. We started last year with Kelly Nikandeha, and it was wonderful. She wrote a book about Advent and about the subversive themes of Advent. A friend of the show that we interviewed way long ago when we first started the podcast, his name is Brian Zond. He's a pastor in Missouri, and he's a brilliant guy. He's written a bunch of books. He talks about nonviolence and the evilness of war in profound ways in some of those books. And he wrote a book called The Anticipated Christ, which is a devotional for Advent. And we thought, let's have a second annual Christmas episode. So here we are. We're about to talk to Brian. But we also are about to taste something that is in the spirit of the season. Mm-hmm, Kyle, tell us about it.
It's eggnog. that's really all there is to say about it. I made it this afternoon, and I'm really excited about it. I've never made eggnog before. I've bought it many times. It's actually really easy to make, and it's way better. And I have poured some Eagle Rare bourbon into mine.
I appreciate you including us in your every afternoon ritual.
Yeah.
I have
right about 4 o'clock. It's that time.
Yeah, no, I'm drinking just the eggnog, sans any booze additions, and it smells incredible.
Yeah.
Like major cinnamon and nutmeg, beautiful
that's,
balance.
That's what it is. That's
but
exactly
like
what it is.
Beautiful balance.
You have cinnamon topper, right?
I do, yes. If you would like to sprinkle some cinnamon, there it is.
That's incredible eggnog, Kyle.
Hmm. I'm glad you think so.
Yeah, what'd you do here?
It's really simple. It's literally just egg yolks and heavy cream, a little bit of sugar. The key is you got to whip it the whole time. Mm-hmm. So you simmer
that makes it healthy.
The cream and milk and everything together. Yeah, that's what makes it healthy. And you whip the shit out of the egg and the sugar.
Now we got to put an eggnog episode.
We were going to have to anyway. And then you just kind of slowly combine them and whip the whole time. I think kind of like you would for hollandaise, although I've never made hollandaise.
Never made hollandaise?
No, my wife is a pro at all that stuff, so it would be silly for me to try.
stick to eggnog, you're good at it.
Yeah, and then you just, season to taste, essentially. So
it's delicious. Yeah. It's not overly heavy, even though when you said eggnog or egg yolks and heavy whipping cream, it made me kind of,
yeah, you'd expect it to
be,
really heavy, but I think the whipping makes it really light.
Well, don't get me wrong, I couldn't drink like a pint of this.
No.
But it's delicious. It's Christmas in a cup.
Yeah.
And now tell me how it is with Eagle Rare.
Put pretty much anything you want in it. I put bourbon, you could use anything.
The Eagle Rare has I don't know if I'm actually tasting Eagle Rare with it. Like, the characteristics of the Eagle Rare, I don't know how much they come through. But I know Eagle Rare tastes kind of buttery, and it's just smooth, unoffensive.
Yeah.
And that character very much comes through.
Yeah, compare it with that and see if you can tell the difference. I can definitely tell
Elliot
the difference.
My non-alcoholic one.
Damn. I might.
It's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
It might be better without. Yeah. I think a light touch with any alcohol you add is important for this.
Well, I would say, eggnog's delicious, and then when you put a little poison in, it gets less delicious.
Yeah. So, cheers.
Cheers. Thank you, Kyle.
Yep. Thanks, Kyle.
Awesome. And maybe we'll post the recipe in the show notes.
Yeah,
what do you think, Kyle?
Let's do it.
Awesome. Brian Zond, thank you so much for joining us again on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We want to talk about your book on Advent, your new devotional, which came out last year. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So super fun, really beautiful devotional. And this is our second annual Christmas episode. So thank you for being our Christmas episode, by the way.
Sure.
You begin your Advent devotional by rejecting the common aphorism that says, I'm spiritual but not religious. You begin this whole section saying this is why you're writing this. You say that being a religious person in an irreligious world is one of our last acts of rebellion. Tell us what you mean when you say that you are a religious person.
I'm trying to be a religious person. I think all of us in Western culture, in late modernity, are default secularists. And I'm trying to rebel against that. I'm trying to be, you know, I mean, it's easy to say you're spiritual. I suppose everybody's spiritual to some extent. I mean, I don't think that's saying much. I need a little rigor. I need something that demands something of me. And I do think that religion is the last act of rebellion in a libertine age. I mean, how else are you going to rebel? You know, this is one of the hallmarks of modernity, is its arrogant rejection of all former tradition and, you know, especially perhaps religious authority. The critique that postmodernity brings of modernity, I like. It is in the sense that postmodernity says, hey, modernity, you're just another tradition. You're a tradition of critiquing all previous traditions. And I would say, as such, it's a rather impoverished tradition. So when religion goes bad, there's nothing worse. Mm-hmm. It's bad religion is the worst. But religion doesn't have to be bad. And so even, you know, among Christians, especially maybe in the Protestant world in the West, have sort of a default attitude of rejecting religion, as if they're emulating Jesus. They're not. They're emulating Voltaire and Nietzsche. Jesus was harshly critical of religious hypocrisy, but not of religion as such. He was a religious man. I mean, he had religious practices. He attended synagogue. He observed a religious diet. We could go on and on and on. And I recognize for my own spiritual formation, I can't leave that up to just make it up as you go, amorphous spirituality. I need some tradition that's been tested and vetted and passed down that I conform to. And you see, all that kind of language flies against the spirit of the age, and that's why I call it rebellion. Mm-hmm.
Can we camp here for just a second?
Of course, I knew you'd have questions, yeah.
What do you think might motivate a person to say, I'm spiritual but not religious, and let's assume that this person is smart?
Well, that they're not just a crass materialist, that they think maybe there is something beyond just materialism philosophically, and so they want to give a tip of the hat to that, but religion has fallen out of favor, and it's easy to critique it. I get that. I would argue that a lot of my day job is doing that. I mean, I have been a strident critic of much that passes for Christianity in America in the 21st century. So I'm on board with that, but I'm just not willing to dismiss religion carte blanche and just say it's all terrible, it's all worthless. Because what are you going to use to tether yourself to something, you know, valuable, rich? Or are you just going to just float in the wind? And so I'm trying to tether myself to an ancient religion called Christianity. And to do that, I need certain practices. And observing Advent would be one of them. Mm-hmm. We can stay here, move on, or I'll talk about whatever. But yeah, I like talking about this stuff.
One more. Okay. Because I do want to talk about Advent, but we could camp here for a long time. What do you think it means to be religious? So you've mentioned practices several times. You've mentioned tethering yourself to a tradition. Seems like there's lots of other ways one might interpret what it means to be religious, some more and some less compatible with what it means to be spiritual.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm prepared to give a "this is my definition." Well, I'd have to really think about that a while, but I'll say this. I'll answer one way and I'll come back around to it. Christianity is a received religion. We don't get to make it up. We do improvise a little bit. We can change, we can reform, we can alter, but that happens slowly over time. The faith itself is something that is passed on. And so I recognize that. And I recognize that I am receiving a gift from our forebearers in the faith. It goes back 2,000 years. And so to be religious has to do with not just having a certain mood towards things spiritual, but actually willing to structure in some way, some aspect of your life around this. There's things that you will do or won't do. There's things that you observe or don't observe because a religion, that is a structure of beliefs and practices that are spiritual in nature, constrains you or impels you to behave in certain ways that may differ from the wider culture. And so that's why I say I'm trying to be religious, because it is an act of rebellion. I don't want to just drift with the current of culture. I'm not one of these, you know, culture warriors that everything's bad. I'm not that guy, you know, but I do need some, I need the great tradition. I need something that comes from beyond myself, beyond my generation. I need something that is ancient, rooted, tested, proven. And so I'm defiantly religious.
Yeah, I actually resonate.
I understand that it's countercultural. I get it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it'd be so easy for me as a pastor of a non-denominational church just to say, I'm not religious, because I know people will like that.
Yeah.
I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. No, I'm religious and trying to be. I'm not very good at being religious. I would like to be better at it.
Yes.
At times I'm too lazy with it, but I aspire to be more religious.
Yeah. I wonder how countercultural that really is. I think there's cultures in which that is very much the norm and valued. But I do resonate a lot with what you're saying. I also just want to make sure we leave space for people for whom any recognized form of religion is unsafe and unhealthy.
Yeah.
And
right.
for whom being spiritual is still very important and valuable. And those are the people I hear say that. And so I just wanted to make sure we left space for that. There's also a YouTube video that everyone should go watch. I cannot remember the channel, but it's about being spiritual, not religious. And it's this, I won't ruin it for you, but at one point the leader in a congregation says, let's all turn to our Twitter feeds to @DeepakChopra. And it just starts reading from it. So
perfect.
Google that. It's great.
Yeah. And just in case any listeners aren't familiar with Brian Zond and think that Brian is just glibly, you know, dismissing spirituality, Brian went through his own season of faith crisis and deconstruction and then reconstruction while pastoring and leading a church. And your faith, Brian, I don't want to go too far much further into this, but your faith is profoundly different than it was when you started pastoring the church, correct?
That's entirely true, yes. The core isn't. I was captured by a fascination with Jesus Christ at a young age. That has remained true. That's been the constant. But a whole lot, once you begin to expand out from that core, a whole lot has changed. In fact, you know, our church today is very different than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, very different.
One last question, and we're going to put this baby to bed and talk about the anticipated Christ. I saw on Twitter today some Theo Bro tweeting about how if your pastor has changed profoundly who he is or what he believes in the last 10 years or whatever, you shouldn't follow him. He's not a leader. What are your thoughts on that kind of take?
Well, I think that's... you're not leaving much room for the work of the Holy Spirit now, are you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at what point should we never change? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess once you're a Reformed Calvinist, that's you've found it and you should never move on from that.
Yes,
that,
and
I
amen. Guess,
that's I assume that's their assumption.
Yeah.
Look, you know, I'm obligated to follow Jesus, and that very term follow implies that there's going to be movement.
Yes.
And, you know, if I could have had perfect theology and been perfectly formed spiritually when I started following Jesus at 16, then I guess I wouldn't have to change now, would I?
Yep.
But that hasn't been the case. And so, like I said, there is a core. There is a core that has remained unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, change, that's growth, that's development, I think that's kind of a sloppy statement to say that.
As my spiritual director says, all living things grow.
Mm-hmm.
That's very simple. So The Anticipated Christ is the book, the Advent devotional, and I highly recommend it for anyone who's looking to just enter into the season in a deeper, more rich way. That's about the only way I can put it. Now, for me, Brian, Christmas has been made into, I think for many of us, Christmas has been made into a kind of a bright and cheery holiday where everything's beautiful and bright and jolly and fun and there's parties, all the things.
Right.
Advent, however, has an altogether different feel from those bright, jolly, cheerful parties. Mm-hmm. We just did a reading on hope this last Sunday in our church, a liturgical prayer and reading, and I entered into a kind of a gloomier, darker space when we started reading, and it felt appropriate. It felt right. So there's a feeling of darkness and longing and even desperation to me, at least. Do you think that's accurate? And how might our experience of Christmas change a bit if we sat in the themes of Advent?
Yeah, a couple of things. Advent is, I think it is all things liturgical are beginning to make a kind of comeback now, because we went to the very bottom of no religion. There's nowhere else to go. And so people are beginning to discover, you know, Advent, Lent, things like that, the church calendar in general. We're talking about Advent. The idea is that we are waiting in the darkness for a hope that has not yet arrived. Mm-hmm. In one sense, Advent is a humble, mild reenactment of Israel's long wait for the promised Messiah. You know, you have these prophecies, and I would say that the messianic prophecies that Christians interpret as referring to Christ can only be understood in retrospect. You couldn't predict what was going to happen, but in retrospect, you look at him, you can kind of see it. But there certainly was a long sustained hope for Messiah that Israel passed through for. I mean, I don't know where you want to begin it. You could begin with, you know, the exile in 587. You could begin with some of these prophecies that we find in Isaiah. You know, so you're talking five or six. If you just go back just that far, you're talking about five or six centuries of waiting. And you know, we're very impatient people. Maybe that's always been true, but I think our technology exasperates the problem of we want everything really instant. Mm-hmm. I've developed a conviction that I think patience and wisdom are so closely related that they're nearly synonymous. I mean, as I look back over my life, and if I wanted to pick out my 10 most foolish moments, I would think they almost all have to do in some way or another with me being impatient. And in moments when I have acted in wisdom, I would say, you know, what I was really doing there was being patient. So Advent stresses that sort of thing, that we don't like waiting because it feels like doing nothing. But that's not true. There is a kind of fortitude that's being developed within us.
Yeah.
That we don't have to have everything we hope for right now, or we just walk away from it all. We're willing to wait. We're willing to sit in the darkness, sit in the silence, sit with the longing, and just wait.
Yeah.
Perry and I can't remember if we were recording yet. I don't think we were. We just walked our fourth Camino de Santiago in Spain. We took a prayer with us that we were using all the time, and we've just brought it back, and now it'll probably be part of my life, part of my prayer life for the rest of my life. It's a prayer from Saint Teresa of Avila. This is one of the 16th century Spanish mystics. And she said, "Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. All things are passing away. God never changes. Patience obtains all things. Whoever has God lacks nothing. God alone suffices." I think probably the spirit of the age would disagree with almost everything said in that. but I believe that. And I especially love that line, patience obtains all things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Advent has to do with a kind of reenactment of Israel's wait, but also esteeming patience as, in fact, a great virtue. Remember, James says, and it's in context of trials, let patience have its perfect work in you, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Very much like what St. Teresa says, patience obtains all things. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what we were talking about exactly, Advent, but anyway, that's just some of my rambling feelings, thoughts on it.
Yep, the feelings of Advent versus the feelings of Christmas and the difference
there. Yeah, now I'm not on it. You'll meet some that come from maybe a long history of very rigid liturgical Advent observances that get upset, you know, if you say Merry Christmas before December 25th, or if you put up the lights, you know, before. I'm not that guy, and I don't want to. I think Christmas or Christmas time, whatever you want to call it, for all the problems. I mean, you can say, okay, it's commercial. So we know this, you know, all that sort of stuff. But still, it is one of the last strongholds that Christian witness has within our culture. And so I lean into it. And admittedly, at Word of Life Church, we are doing a fair amount of conflating Christmas and Advent. We, as far as like how we speak in church, we try to kind of keep them a little bit distinct, but we're putting up the lights and we're also being festive too. So mm-hmm. we're kind of trying to do both at the same time without feeling that somehow that's wrong.
Yeah. So before Kyle asks about Christmas and all that, in the book you say something to the effect of, we would all be wise to cultivate waiting in our lives.
Yeah.
Pastor Zond, how do I cultivate waiting in my life?
I think contemplative prayer is a very countercultural practice. This is, I don't have time to teach on and all this, but this is prayer without words, mm-hmm. without really even expectation of anything happening. I call it sitting with Jesus, mm-hmm. just to sit in silence, mm-hmm. acknowledging the presence of the Lord and sitting for a period of time in utter silence. I mean, because it feels so much like doing nothing. And yet, if you really are sitting with Jesus, well, then everything's happening. Christ is the wisdom of God, the healing of God, the grace of God, the salvation of God, all of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the presence of that. Mm-hmm. I don't have to have some sensation of thought or an empirical sensation, something I hear or see or feel or something like that. It's a moment of pure faith, mm-hmm. where I'm content with doing nothing, mm-hmm. with being still and knowing God. And I think that it's very hard at first because we're not used to anything like this, and it's so different from everything we do. I mean, I'm not saying this is some sort of magical trick and all of a sudden you'll be, you know, a mystical saint and never disturbed, but it's a place to begin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's surely a centering practice. I mean, I would say it qualifies as 85% of my prayer life these days, and I feel like my prayer life has never been richer. And I feel like I have less questions when it comes to the idea of prayer, because prayer for me is less, you know, a Christmas list and more mm-hmm. sitting in the presence of Christ, like you're talking about.
Yes.
Nice connection with the Christmas list.
There you go.
It reminds me of that old Pascal quote, something like, all of humanity's problems stem from our inability to sit quietly in a room alone.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe Advent is a practice that could help us with that. So, do you have kids, Brian?
I have three adult grown sons, and I have 8 grandchildren.
Congratulations.
13 and 13 to 2.
I have two. One of them is 2 and one of them is 2 months. And so I'm just learning. And so I'm going to ask you for some
children,
wisdom
is, not
here.
Grandchildren.
Not grandchildren.
Yeah, I made that change in my mind.
So next question is kind of about how to parent in this context that you're teaching us about. So I confess that, like most of my life at this point, frankly, Christmas is mostly secularized for me right now. Mm-hmm. Part of that is just having children and wanting them to experience the joy of the season. Part of it is the religious forms just don't feel at home right now anymore. Maybe they will eventually. I hope for that. But it is really much more about being jolly and playful than it is about waiting or longing in darkness. But when I read A Charlie Brown Christmas to my son, which I did the other day, and you get to the part where Linus tells Charlie Brown what Christmas is all about, and he quotes Luke 2, I choke up, and I can't avoid it. And it's got to be because underneath it all, it's really about hoping for something better than what's here.
Mm-hmm.
So any advice on how I can preserve that core for my kids without destroying the joy of it?
All I can do is tell you my favorite memory as a child regarding Christmas. And it was a tradition. You know, childhood flies by so quick in reality, but not when you're a child. You know, so, you know, let's say, you know, from the ages of 2 to 12, you know, that's 10 years. But feeling it at that time is like 100 years. And one of our traditions, I can see even as a child, I probably loved Christmas Eve more than Christmas Day. I love Christmas. What child doesn't? I like the presents and all that. But I wouldn't have been able to articulate this as a child. But I love that sense of mystery, wonder, awe. I wouldn't have used any of those words. But, you know, the Christmas tree, the lights off. And it's very simple. And my dad would read 2 stories. He would first read The Night Before Christmas. And then he would read Luke 2, King James Bible. Because, you know, I want those shepherds sore afraid. that's how I want my when I got my shepherds, I want them sore afraid.
Let's go.
And, you know, some would say, well, okay, you know, one is this fable of a Santa Claus and the other you actually hold to with, you know, deep conviction. Does that mess up? But it doesn't mess up a child. You're giving them a great gift with these 2 stories. Hmm. And I think probably all children somehow instinctively know how to fit them in their proper compartments. And they don't have to be explained. Just read the 2 stories, you know, and then have some cookies or something. That's what we did. Mm-hmm. And I think providing children with wonder, that's a good thing to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And hopefully learning that ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Returning to the book. So the first half or so of the book takes passages from Isaiah and uses those as the mm-hmm. inspiration. I might expect a devotional about Christmas to be primarily from the New Testament, but we didn't actually get to the New Testament until about halfway through.
Well, it's Advent though. So I'm kind of waiting.
So I want you to explain the emphasis on Isaiah, how you take Isaiah, how you understand Isaiah just in general. And I was particularly struck by, I don't know how I've been a Christian my whole life without knowing this, that Isaiah has the same number of chapters as books in the Bible and that there's the same division in the middle. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, because it blew my mind.
You know, I think scholarship is universally agreed that there's at least 2 authors operating under the name of Isaiah, maybe mm-hmm. 3, but let's keep it simple and mm-hmm. say 2. And we have Isaiah of Jerusalem writing before the exile and the destruction of Jerusalem, and then you have Isaiah of the exile. And they're very different. And it's the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, like the Old Testament, having 39 books. There's a lot of woe unto you. Woe. There's just a ton of woes. Because there's this call to repentance and this warning of judgment. But then, you know, the catastrophe has befallen. 587, the destruction of Jerusalem, forced deportation to Babylon, all that. And it changes then. Now, there's a gap probably in the actual compiling of these documents. There's a gap of probably like 150 years. But then everything changes. And it's you know, the very first words of Isaiah 40. This is second Isaiah. Mm-hmm. Comfort ye my people.
Yes.
And there's these series of songs, that's what they are, poetry, that are envisioning a hopeful future. And they're mysterious. One of the more mysterious aspects of these poems are the series of, we call them the songs of the suffering servant. Because Isaiah imagines Israel as the servant of Yahweh, but he often presents it as a single person, probably as a literary technique. But he envisions that this servant of Yahweh is going to bring about some kind of salvation, but only through tremendous suffering. Well, and then, you know, when the first Christians began to read their Bible, and it's what we would call the Old Testament, they just couldn't not see Jesus there. And so, to the extent that one of the church fathers, it's either Tertullian or Jerome, and I've forgotten which one. I think Jerome, but I'm not 100% sure. He's the one that gave us the term, a lot of people have used it since, that Isaiah is the fifth gospel. That gospel themes are so prevalent. Now, if you want to do like some really literary criticism, you would say, well, that's because actually the gospel writers are working with material from Isaiah and structuring their gospel around. So be it. I'm fine with that. But there is this tremendous connection between the canonical gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and this other gospel that is the book of Isaiah. So, yeah, so I spent a lot of time working with what we would call messianic prophecies.
Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you say that Isaiah, along with probably the book of Psalms, is just filled with themes of waiting, of hope,
filled,
of longing?
Filled.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And you talk about the Magnificat a little bit. Mm-hmm. You talk about Mary's song and Mary's experience. And speaking of the Magnificat, you say that Advent is not just about waiting, but it's about waiting in the right place.
Yeah.
When you're talking about the Magnificat, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, let me just say, you know, so for those that don't know, the Magnificat is, that's the first word in Latin of the Latin translation of that passage in Luke 1. Magnify the Lord, you know, so that's where it comes from. It's really, in some ways, as an adaptation of Hannah's song. Mm-hmm. That you get in 1 Samuel 1. And then you have Mary's song, as it's often called, is in an adaptation of that. I mean, it's a revolutionary kind of song.
Yes.
And it's a song that says that God is getting ready to act, but that God is going to fill the hungry and send the rich away empty. God is going to fill the hungry, but send the rich away empty. Of course, we find this in Matthew. It's in Luke's gospel. And then when you get to Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount, it's the Sermon on the Plain, and they're similar but different. Matthew has all of the blessings, the Beatitudes. Luke has that and the woes. And it'd be easy for me just to read you one and explain what I mean here. This is Luke 6. Then he looked at his disciples and said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you who hungry now, for you'll be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh." But then he goes on and says, "Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you will be hungry. Woe to you who are laughing now, for you will mourn and weep." That fits really well with the Magnificat. And so it isn't just waiting. It's, okay, I need to identify the places in my life where I am weak, mm-hmm. where I am destitute, where I am broken, where I'm hungry, where I'm empty, and wait there. I mean, God doesn't really show up to the places in our life where we're sated and satisfied and content. It's God comes to the person or to the places in our own life where we're broken, empty, poor, destitute. And so it's he lifts. This isn't in the Magnificat. This isn't Hannah's song, but they're related. It says he lifts the poor out of the ash heap and makes them sit with the princes. So find those areas of your life that are an ash heap, where it's burned out and burned up and it's all gone wrong. Sit there.
Interesting.
With some sort of, maybe not terribly defined, but a vague hope that maybe God could meet me here.
Mm-hmm. We just spoke to Willie James Jennings, and one of the things that he said was how fascinating it is that God was taught by his mother how to live in the dirt, right? How to live in real life, what it means to be human in many ways. Yeah. And it, as you talk, it reminds me of that thinking, well, of course Jesus taught the Sermon on the Mount because he was raised by his mother who sang the, who created this Magnificat,
right,
who had this theology in the dirt, rooted in the dirt, rooted in the God who sees the lowly and meets them in that place.
It's, Amen.
Yeah, the humanity of Jesus strikes me so brilliantly in the Incarnation and Christmas. So in speaking of the Magnificat of Mary's song, it haunts me that a bit that we have a church in America that sings patriotic songs during the summer, right? We've all grown up in them. Maybe even you did it in Word of Life before your deconstruction or reconstruction. I don't know. But I remember singing patriotic songs in Memorial Day and 4th of July, and those were our favorite Sundays of the year. Friggin' loved them. But then we also have churches hosting political candidates and waving American flags and doing all sorts of things. And the Magnificat is relegated to this inspirational Amy Grant song, even though I love Amy Grant and love Breath of Heaven, praise the Lord. What would a Christianity that is shaped by the real version of Mary's song perhaps look like in America?
Yeah, man, I don't know where to go with that. There's so many things to say there. Yes, Word of Life, you know, we've been on this 42-year-long journey, and we just have to learn as we went. We sort of just followed the lead of what other churches were doing, and we did all that stuff, all that, I would call it, you know, somewhat innocent idolatry, although it's not so much innocent anymore.
Yeah.
One of the things that helped us get away from that is to be very serious about the church calendar. And so when people say to me, well, it's 4th of July and you guys didn't say anything, or it's, you know, we're coming up on Memorial Day or Veterans Day or one of these days, you know, and you guys don't even acknowledge it at Word of Life. I say, yeah, we don't. It's not our calendar. It's not on the church calendar. We follow the church calendar, not the secular calendar of the United States. I mean, you're asking me a question that I don't know how to, I know how to respond to it. I don't know how to respond to it in under like 30 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's
that,
just
that we have to decide which kingdom we belong to. And there is no conflation with the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of Babylon. And I suppose the revelation that caused me the most trouble as a pastor and enabled me to lose a whole lot of people was that America is not a kind of biblical Israel, but a kind of biblical Babylon. And I preached that and was quite clear on that. And, you know, we got rid of any flags or any of that business. And that's, see, America is a behemoth. It's big. It's four things simultaneously. It's a geopolitical state. It's a culture. It's an empire. And it's a religion. Mm-hmm. Now, when I talk about America as a nation and a culture, there's much to critique, and I do that. But there's much also that's admirable and worth celebrating. This also is true.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about America as an empire, now it becomes problematic because empires are rich, powerful nations who believe they have a divine right to rule other nations and a manifest destiny to shape history according to their agenda. And they try to usurp the authority that God has given to his son, Jesus Christ. And then finally, America is a religion. And I know I just say that sort of calmly, and I know that people would freak out and get upset, but I mean, really, is it deniable? It's a religion complete with sacred documents and holy days and sacred ground and liturgical gestures, sacred documents, foundational myths, on and on it goes. the apotheosis of Washington in the rotunda of the Capitol building. That is where George Washington has ascended into the heavens and is seated in the heavens as a god. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I call it the apotheosis of Washington, that's not me giving it the name. That's actually the name of it. that's what it's called, the deification or apotheosis of Washington. Mm-hmm. So we're getting a little bit away from Advent, but trusting the church calendar helps you avoid that sort of mess a little bit. Things like, preaching the Magnificat is good anti-imperial theology. Yes. Amen.
Yes.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, no, it just struck me reading you talk about the Magnificat, how we have churches who in summertime will sing Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and America the Beautiful, and all the things, and yet the gospel was born out of a song by a teenage mom bearing Christ, who said, "He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty." Now that is a paradox.
Yeah.
And those two things don't work together is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, my guess would be, this is sort of an educated guess, the churches that are super patriotic and really bring a lot of that into their church and Battle Hymn of the Republic and all that business, I think they avoid the Magnificat. I don't think it's part of their liturgy.
A little bit inconvenient.
I just think they don't lean into that aspect of Christmas.
Yeah.
So kind of related, a little bit of a gear shift here. If anybody knows Brian Zond, one of the things they probably know you for is the sort of stuff you were just riffing on, but also your stance against nationalized violence. And that comes up early in the book, and I want to just read a little passage here if I can.
Okay.
So you say, "For the first three centuries, the church viewed the waging of war as incompatible with following Christ, not because they were ethical pacifists, but simply because they belonged to the kingdom that shall learn war no more. For the early Christians, war belonged to the antiquated kingdoms of the world that had not yet submitted to the reign of Christ. War was now an abolished and antichrist anachronism. Christians, by virtue of their baptism, belong to the age to come." So can you just tell us a bit about the connection there to Advent?
Well, in one way it's connected is, this is from the very famous prophecy in Isaiah 2. This is the plowshares, the swords to plowshares and spears to pruning hooks passage, that something is going to happen with the reign of Messiah that will cause the people of God to be peaceable and to study war no more, as the poem goes. The early Christians, I alluded to this earlier, were so obsessed with finding Jesus in their Bibles, which for them was the Old Testament, and they see that in Isaiah 2, verse 4, and they say, well, that's happened. We're no longer waiting for that. That has occurred. Mm-hmm. And so now the time for us to turn swords to plowshares, spears to pruning hooks, and learn war no more has arrived. And so for the early church, before it got tangled up with Constantine in the early 4th century, for three centuries, the church simply said, we will not be a part of waging war. And they were not naive idealists that thought they were going to eliminate war from the earth. They just said, that's Babylon, that's the age prior to Christ, that's not us. We belong to something other. We belong to a different kingdom, a different age, and so we are not necessarily trying to directly eliminate war. We're simply going to be that part of the world already saved and transformed by Christ, and we're going to live accordingly. And the church did. And it was only when they, when the church was offered kind of a seat at the table of imperial power with the conversion of Constantine. And by the way, I think that it was obviously a mistake, at least from my vantage point, for the church to get involved with the Roman Empire and allow itself to be co-opted as essentially the state religion. I also think it was an inevitable mistake. I don't know how they avoided making that mistake. I think it would have just seemed so, that, you know, we have this opportunity.
It's a heady
wine. I can't imagine someone saying, I've heard that this new Roman emperor is some kind of Christian, and Christians somewhere off in Corinth going, well, we're not going to put up with that now, are we? I mean, I think they're going to hear that as good news, especially coming out just on the heels of the Emperor Diocletian and his very vigorous state-sponsored persecution of Christians. I think it was inevitable they made that mistake. But my point is, we're 17 centuries into this. And Christendom is a failed experiment, and I think anybody that's serious and paying attention should be aware of that. I mean, where does it ultimately lead you? If you follow that long enough, you arrive at the two great world wars in Europe in the 20th century, where in the name of national allegiance, you have Christians killing Christians by the millions. So something went wrong there somewhere. And I think Advent heralds a time when there will be peace on earth. Christians say the Prince of Peace has come. This is the Son that's given to us, that we call Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, the trick though that we've learned since Constantine is we say, oh, no, Jesus has to come a second time before we actually begin to live as if his kingdom has been established. This is this kind of hermeneutical trick of kicking the can down the road. And I just say we have to stop that. Christ has come. He is Lord, and the world will be the world. But the church is to be the church. This is what Stanley Hauerwas is getting at when he says the primary task of the church is to make the world, by which he means the church is to be something radically other than the world, so that you actually have a contrast. So you can say, okay, this is what the world does, but the church does something different.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So while we're talking about this in our part of the world, at the same time, in what we call, or many people call, the Holy Land, it's being torn apart mm-hmm. by war between Israel and Hamas. And you say at one point, I found peace and beauty in Bethlehem, but I've also seen separation walls, rubber bullets, tear gas canisters there. Christ is not just born in the beautiful places of our lives. Jesus was not born into a fairy tale, but into the world as it is. Can you give us some pastoral counsel on what is an appropriate response to the war that's happening in Israel and in Gaza, and how we understand that connection to Advent, Brian?
Yeah. Yes and no, I can and I can't. First of all, let me say, just with all seriousness, I probably understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm probably in the 1/10 of 1 percentile. I mean, I've spent enough time there. You know, I've visited there over 30 times. I've been in Gaza. There are very few Americans that have been in Gaza. I've been to Gaza. I understand the problem. I don't have a solution. If they said, Brian, we're going to put you in charge today, well, they're not gonna do that. And whatever I would suggest wouldn't be done anyway. So let me be a lot more modest now and say I don't have any advice to give to Palestinians. I don't have advice to give to Palestinian Christians, and I have many friends. I pray for them by name every day. I'm praying every day for Sandy and Mona and Jack and Munther and on and on and on. These are dear friends of mine that are right in the thick of this. I used to have friends in Gaza. I don't have any friends there now. They moved out some time ago. I mean, a few years ago. But I've had friends there. I've known people there. So I don't have any advice to give to them. I just don't. I pray for them. I have plenty of Israeli friends. I have a few Israeli Christian friends. I have more Israeli Jewish friends. I mean, when I say friends, I mean like really dear friends, people I've known 30 years and really love. I don't have advice to give to them. What I do say, I would maybe have something to say to Christians living in North America. And I would say, beware of being swept up into hatred. There is a way of framing the story where it's really easy to hate what Israelis hate. It's really easy to frame the story a different way where you can, you, some of the hatred that's found in the Palestinian people right now, it's, it, it'd be easy to embrace that and feel very righteous. The last thing we need is more hatred. I'm not, you know, you say, are you just doing this, you know, this both sideism and all, it's complex. It's, I'm not, that's not what I'm trying to do. I mean, I'm trying to be faithful to Christ, but I don't have a simple, that I can find in the stories, I can find evil, all right, on both sides. I can find that, but that's not where I want to sit. And I understand that I could take a side and just be 100% there, and pretty soon I'm going to be hating. And so I want to weep with those that weep. I want, of course, I made it very, I think I've made it with my life. I've made it very clear that waging war is incompatible with following Christ. So, you know, am I for a ceasefire? Of course I am. Do I understand the settlements and the? I totally understand that, and that's been. I mean, Jimmy Carter was saying this 40 years ago, that these illegal settlements by Israeli settlers in Palestinian territories is going to make a two-state solution almost impossible. It's going to aggravate the problem to the point where we're seeing what we're seeing. I understand all of that. I just don't know. I mean, Netanyahu isn't asking my opinion on this. Certainly Hamas is not asking my opinion on this. And so with Christians, I just say, try to find the way of love. Try to find the way of peace. Don't feel like you have to have an answer, because you don't. Avoid reducing something that is the most complex problem I know of in human, you know, political relations in the world today, into some sort of simplistic form where it's just easy for you to look at it through a lens of black and white, good guys, bad guys, and keep it. You've deceived yourself if you do that, and you're not going to be part of the solution. You're just going to be bringing more hate to the table. I responded to your question. I'm completely unsatisfied with my response.
Yeah, no, that's.
But I don't know what else to say. Maybe, hopefully, you hear that there's a brokenheartedness in my words. And I said, do I have something to say? Yes and no. Mm-hmm. So I started off a little bit of yes, but ultimately, no, I don't have anything to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have tears, and I can weep, and I can pray for people that I know by name and send them texts. And how you doing, Gotti? How you doing, Susan? And I just know I'm praying for you. Mm-hmm. And I do that.
Yep. So, Brian, I don't know about Kyle, I have one more real question, and then we're going to have some fun.
Okay. Yeah, okay. We need to have some fun.
Yes. Here's the real question, though, or the thought that I'd love to hear your thoughts on. One of the haunting parts of Advent for me is how so many of God's people, centuries, millennia ago, longed for the coming of the Messiah, but also the reality of how few people actually recognized the Messiah when Jesus arrived, like John's prologue speaks to. I feel like we American Christians might be in a similar dynamic, that we long for Jesus, we long for God to show up, as we talked about in Sunday service this last Sunday, to rend the heavens and come down, right? Like the psalmist said.
Yeah.
But I feel like when God does rend the heavens and come down, we American Christians might be pretty similar to first century Palestinian Jewish people in that many of us miss God when God shows up. Would you agree with that? And is there something about Advent that can root us in a place where we see and recognize the person of Christ and the movement of God and the presence of God, maybe when we're looking for it, but we can't see it right before our face?
Yeah, I think so. The idea of longing for Messiah to come, and Messiah comes and certain people miss him, that's a tragedy, but it's not an inevitable tragedy, and it's not based on how smart you are or how well you knew the Bible or anything like that. The key is really given to us by Jesus in the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are not necessarily commands to be a certain way, as Jesus just acknowledging, these are the people that are most well suited to recognize what I'm announcing as good news. Blessed are the poor, poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. They'll be comforted. Blessed are the meek. That's the one Americans believe the least. Blessed are the meek. They'll inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice. They'll be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful. They'll receive mercy. Pure in heart. They'll see God, perceive God where others don't. Blessed are the peacemakers. They'll be called the children of God. They're in the family business. And blessed are those who are persecuted for all the right reasons, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So when Messiah is missed, it's almost always because we are, we imagine ourselves as the first and at the top, and we don't want anything to change. We are in some sort of privileged position where the way the world is arranged presently is advantageous for us, and so we're not looking for any change. I mean, when Christ comes, he does come to change. And so I always think about when Jesus says, many who are first will be last, and those who are last shall be first. You know, the people that are occupying the bottom rungs of society, they're like, yeah, sign me up. And the people, though, that are, you know, in the Roman in his villa, the Sanhedrin living in the upper part of Jerusalem, there in those palaces, you know, the Herodians and all of that, they're like, I gotta tell me more about this great reversal you're speaking of. So that's why I say, if we can wait, I mean, you may not, you know, someone may not be financially poor. Well, a couple of things I would say. If you don't want to miss the presence of Christ, do a couple of things. One, give to the poor. But secondly, identify some area of your life that's impoverished. Okay, it's not your money. You've got plenty of money. Well, it's something else. What area of your life are you impoverished? Where, what area of your life are you broken in? What area of your life are you actually destitute? Go there, lean into that, identify with that. Don't sweep it under the rug and say, I need Christ to come to me in this part of my life. I mean, haven't we heard enough testimonies over the years of it's when those people found that area of their life and cried out from there, from the belly of hell, to, you know, borrow Jonah's language, that's when God came to them. So I think Advent's for doing things like that.
Brilliant. So Brian, you are a music lover.
I am.
It's very, very obvious. And you put together an Advent playlist, which I think might, you know, ruffle some feathers with this Advent playlist, because it's filled with artists like Bob Dylan and the Arcade.
Brother, I've been ruffling feathers musically for decades.
Yeah, good. So it's filled with names like Bob Dylan, Arcade Fire, Jimi Hendrix, and many more. Tell us about your Advent playlist and how we can find it.
Well, I'm gonna pull it up here.
I'm looking at it right
playlists,
now.
Playlists, search, Advent. There it is. 296 saved. It's 2 hours and 3 minutes long. I'm not sure how many songs it is. It starts off with "Comfort Ye My People," which makes sense, right? this is, you know, Handel's Messiah. Mm-hmm. But then it goes to "When You're Going to Wake Up," because one of the themes of Advent, especially if you pay attention to the lectionary readings, is because it leans also into Second Advent stuff. And, you know, stay awake. Mm-hmm. Don't go to sleep. Mm-hmm. Something's about to happen. You don't want to miss it. Don't be like the five foolish virgins. So "When You're Going to Wake Up," which is actually just a full-on Christian song by Dylan. "Wake Up" by Arcade Fire. "We Used to Wait," because now we're into the waiting thing. We used to wait, so we're not waiting anymore. "All Along the Watchtower," which actually comes right out of Isaiah.
Yeah, no, is that right?
I didn't know that.
Neither did I.
Yeah. Now, hold on. Let me see if I can find it here. Isaiah. It's in Isaiah 20, I want to say 22.
Brian's literally paging through his Bible right now.
There's a passage where it talks about a watchman, and it talks about two riders approaching.
Is it Isaiah 21?
"On the watchtower I stand, O Lord. Can you hear anybody?" This is Isaiah 21. when he sees riders, horsemen, and bears approaching, the watchman calls out. Anyway, it's adapted from Isaiah 21. It's a great song. Of course, we all know that. I won't go through the whole thing, but there's like songs like Night Watchman, The Waiting. Mm-hmm. That's Tom Petty. Yeah. Waiting is the hardest part.
Come on.
Waiting, Green Day. I'm Waiting for the Man, Velvet Underground. That's, people won't know that song, but it's cool. Waiting on the World to Change, John Mayer, a little more pop there. Seasons, Waiting on You.
I love
anybody
that
know
song. I love
Future Islands? I love that. Yeah. Y'all know Future Islands? So
good. And I never want to listen to Future Islands. I want to watch them because the front man is totally just
absolutely
a situation.
That's, yes, I tip my hat to that. That's exactly right.
Amen.
That guy with his moves. Oh.
He's awesome. Got moves.
Yeah, no, I say the same thing. I really don't want to listen to him. I want to watch him. Yeah. I get it. Waiting in Vain, Bob Marley, Redemption Song, throwing that. I'm proud of this one. The Wait. You know, the band, the W-A.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
E-I-G-H-T. Mm-hmm. Pulled into Nazareth, feeling about half past dead. Oh, it does have, I was talking about how bad religion. Well, bad religion is bad unless we're talking about the Los Angeles hardcore punk band.
Yes.
Bad
yes.
Religion. And they put out a Christmas album. Do you know about this?
Mm-hmm. No.
You know, they're a hardcore punk band. Let's see, View Album. Let me go to View Album. It's Bad Religion Christmas Songs. And it's hardcore punk, but they don't change the words or anything. It's Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Oh Come All You Faithful. Little Drummer Boy, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen.
That's hilarious. Kyle's looking it up right now.
I am.
So, Brian... You, my wife thinks that I compare too much. I compare artists or I compare, you know, everything. I like it. And I really feel affirmed by you on Twitter because you compare a lot of artists and you have a lot of polls. Who's better? So let's do a little.
I love doing that stuff. I know it just hacks people off. But
yeah, screw them. We don't care about them. So I'm going to mention a few bands and I want you to tell me. Rate them in order of importance and
brother.
Okay, best.
Well,
rock
I call them the fly. I got to do this. Okay.
These are similar bands.
All right.
Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, and the Rolling Stones.
I am of the school of Jack Black when he said, "Led Zeppelin."
Good. All right. That's
greatest rock band in history. Not the Beatles. Not the Stones, Led Zeppelin.
Correct. That's the only correct
answer. So Led Zeppelin, to me, is in a different category. They are, you know, you think at every position, you know.
They're the best.
They're just the best.
Nasty, bluesy.
Black Sabbath, they were the group, actually, when I was a teenager, that they accomplished what they wanted to, and that was they scared me. Songs like
the
Iron Man and I was like, ooh, these guys.
Yes.
This is scary music. And the Stones are a little different. You know, they're competing with the Beatles. They're, you know, they do the best with the blues. They're a rock and roll band. And that's exactly what Keith Richards will say. He says, in comparing them with Led Zeppelin, he says, you know, Led Zeppelin's like a marching band. Mm-hmm. And he said, we're more the roll. Mm-hmm. He said, I like the roll.
Nice.
I mean, I know people have died and they've had to replace, you know, a bass player and all that, but that they've stayed together.
It's incredible.
That Mick and Keith found a way, mm-hmm. you know, that's an amazing thing. And it's been good for them. And I love the Stones. You know, they came out with a new album. I really like that Sweet Sounds of Heaven, the one they do with Lady Gaga. But I mean, it's, you know, I still want to listen to Exile on Main Street.
Yes.
Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers. That's the Stones I want to hear.
Okay. So we have the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. Era, you can jump in whenever you want.
That's great.
Yeah, let's fast forward, way forward, to some bands that I know you enjoy, but I want to hear your you know, ordering. Foo Fighters,
mm-hmm.
the Black Keys, mm-hmm. and the Queens of the Stone Age.
I've seen them all, and I saw front row at Starlight for Black Keys and Queens of the Stone Age within the last few months for both of them. Black Keys are a little, I'll talk about them first. They're a little different. Mm-hmm. They don't quite fit with those two. They start off as a duo. They're one of the bands I got into from the very beginning.
Okay,
same. I'm very proud of
that. So I could see them when they're playing knuckleheads in Kansas City, you know, with 50 people. And I liked them from day one when they were purely a duo, like Thick Freakness and like that.
They got poppier for sure.
But it was good.
Tasty.
And I like it. And but it's simple. It's, you know, they love the blues, and it's blues based rock and roll.
Yep.
And they do it as well as anybody. And I like it a lot, but I don't find it terribly intriguing. That may sound like I don't really like them. No, I really like them, because sometimes that's just what you want. Now let's talk about the Foo Fighters and Queens of the Stone Age. They are the light and the dark. they're very similar in some ways.
Yes.
Foo Fighters are the light, mm-hmm. and Queens of the Stone Age are the dark. Queens of the Stone Age is my favorite rock band. I mean, Zeppelin would be, but, you know, that's as far as, like, you know, active rock bands.
It absolutely counts.
Queens,
as far as
favorite.
Bands that aren't like Incarnate Angels.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, you could, of course, Dave Grohl's always appreciative. And of course, you know, Dave Grohl played on some of the earlier Queens of the Stone Age albums, played drums and toured with him one time.
Yep.
And wouldn't that be awesome? See Queens mm-hmm. of the Stone Age with Dave Grohl on drums.
He's an animal.
But he says, you could just go to YouTube. There's going to be language because it's Dave Grohl. but they ask him about just search Dave Grohl, Queens of the Stone Age. And there's a little clip just like under a minute. And he says, Queens of the Stone Age, best rock and roll band in the world. He says, when they take the stage, they're the best rock band in the world. As far as musicianship and just being badasses.
Yep.
And he says, and
I think that's true.
I love Queens of the Stone Age. And I know that, like, I'll regularly do like a poll, Foo Fighters versus Queens of the Stone Age. Everybody votes for Foo Fighters because mm-hmm. Dave Grohl's adorable.
Yeah. Yep.
And you like him. And I do like him.
I've had more
Foo
hits,
Fighters, but Queens of the Stone Age occupies a different place. Like I find them more intriguing. I find them more interesting.
Can I add a band to this mix and see if it changes your analysis at all? White Stripes.
Of course.
I love the White Stripes. But it, if you're talking about with Meg White, which you are.
Yes.
I mean, you didn't say Jack White. You said White Stripes.
Yes.
Because there's
a little bit of a
because there's too much. There's too much Jack White.
Yes.
There was a little bit of a shtick there.
There was, yeah.
I mean, they won't admit it, but it kind of was.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like the album Elephant. Mm-hmm. That's a great rock album.
Yep. Yeah.
But I don't know if, you know, I don't know who's really playing drums and some other stuff. Jack White is a way better musician than who's the guitar player with Black Keys.
Dan Auerbach, yeah.
Dan Auerbach, thank
there you.
Oh, it's bugging me. If I wasn't like on TV, I could have done this.
You said you don't pay attention to the nylon, Brian. You're the one.
he's a way better guitar. I mean, Jack White's a way better musician, but sometimes he'll go off and do experimental things that mm-hmm. I don't really care that much for.
Yes.
The Black Keys, they kind of just know who they are. They stay right there in their wheelhouse. They're not getting too experimental with it. I like them both. I didn't like it that Jack White was kind of upset with the Black Keys.
Yeah,
I mean, White Stripes, Black Keys, duo. I get it. But he was saying, well, they're ripping me off. I was like, Jack, you didn't invent blues-based rock.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys are ripping off tons of people.
Exactly.
You're ripping off Muddy Waters. You're ripping off, you know, Howlin' Wolf. You're ripping off whoever.
He's ripping off the Rolling Stones.
That's just the way rock works. You're always ripping off somebody.
It's music.
Yeah, but I think the Black Keys never had a good as album as the White Stripes Elephant. That's a mm-hmm. great album.
Yeah,
I mean
Biscuit and Ball, Black Math. Of course, everybody knows Seven Nation Army.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Hardest Button to Button. White Blood Cells is really good too.
Oh, the whole that's really I love good. Their whole catalog.
Yeah, so here's my last little. You know, maybe Kyle can jump in, but my last little genre of comparison. And with this one, please feel free to submit any grunge or alternative band from the '90s that you want. My kind of trinity of grunger 90s rock bands would be in no particular order. Well, I'll say it in no particular order. There is an order. Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, and Nirvana.
You want me to rank them?
Yeah, go ahead.
Nirvana.
Easy.
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy. And probably Alice in Chains. And then, but what about Soundgarden?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. And I like them all. Now, how old are you? I'm just going to ask 45. You. How old 45.
Kyle?
I'm 36, I think.
Yeah. So you guys are the right age to, you know, the 90s.
I spent a shit ton of time with Nirvana. And quite a bit of time with Pearl Jam. I don't think I ever listened.
There just isn't that much Nirvana music, you know.
That's true. You can. It's problem. Easy to listen but to all of it so numerous good. Times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Nirvana is to, like, modern rock and roll, to me, what the Beatles were to pop in the 60s and, mm-hmm. and 70s. They changed the game. Like, there's good music, and then there's influential music, and that's both of them for me for Nirvana.
Yeah.
I would mm-hmm. say.
I had a student a couple years ago came into class wearing a Nirvana shirt, and I was like, have you actually listened to them? Because it's kind of a popular thing to do to wear old yep. band shirts you've never right. heard. But he was actually a fan, and he was like 19. I was like, yes, this lives on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great band. Kurt Cobain was one of those, you know, once in a generation talents, just the charisma, all of that. You know, it's interesting that Dave Grohl was writing music even in the Nirvana period, but he was too intimidated by Kurt Cobain to suggest any songs. So he was just doing it like secretly. Mm-hmm. And then after Kurt Cobain's death, just part of his healing process was he made that first Foo Fighters album where he literally plays everything.
And it's so good. Yeah, early Foo Fighters are way better than late Foo Fighters, let's also be honest.
I will say
everything. Yeah, they tend to move a little bit more formulaic. It begins, okay, we sound like this. Well, this is what all of our songs are going to sound like.
What was the album they did that was like straight driving rock? And it was not that long ago.
Monkey Wrench?
I really liked it. I don't remember the
name. I like Monkey Wrench.
I like it when they're heavy. That's my favorite thing.
I do too. Yeah. See, people think because Dylan is my musical. It's not. I mean, I like his music, but he's completely a different category.
Musical Messiah.
Yeah, and but it's his, I love Dylan because of the language, the lyrics, his genius. I just love language, and I don't think anybody's done anything better with language in the last 100 years than Bob Dylan.
Leonard Cohen.
That's why you give him a Nobel Prize for. Literature. Yeah, Leonard Cohen's great, but he doesn't have the wild poetry that Dylan can have. And I think
this would be a whole argument.
but because people associate me with a deep devotion to Bob Dylan, they think I'm a folky guy. Mm-hmm. And that I'm just like, you know, really mostly listening to singer-songwriters. That's really not true. I'm listening to Dylan and then heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And I haven't mellowed out. I'm as heavy as I've ever been. I love the new Metallica album, The 72 Seasons. I think it's a great album.
And let me throw in one last album or one last band into the 90s mix is Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, see, and what's his name? Tom
Morello.
Morello. Whew. There's a guitar player. And see, there's a guitar player that's not, I mean, he's breaking new ground.
Yes.
He doesn't sound like somebody else. He isn't like just, you know, Hendrix, Clapton, whatever. Mm-hmm. He did something new.
Well, he's a mix of like a DJ and a lead guitarist. I mean, with the scratching and the... He does incredible things, yeah.
Yeah. Should we talk about Radiohead? We should probably call this.
I love Radiohead.
Radiohead's the best.
You know, does Radiohead exist anymore?
They do, man. They do. They're still making stuff. York is still doing solo stuff, yeah.
Yeah, they're freaking brilliant, yeah. Yep. Well, Brian Zahn, the book is The Anticipated Christ, a devotional that will guide you through Advent and after Advent. We didn't even talk about the 12 days of Christmas, which I really wanted to, but it leads you into Epiphany, which is the whole Christmas season. Highly recommend it for those who are looking for a companion to dig into the Christmas spirit, the heart of Advent. Thanks for joining us, Brian. We had a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying these conversations. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode.
If anything we said pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Find us on social media at @PPWBpodcast, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com.
See you next time.
Cheers.